I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors from the University of Alberta, Iowa State University, and a whole slew of field people from the USDA NRCS who helped us with soil profile descriptions during this study. The story begins back in the Dust Bowl. Persistent droughts in the 1930s led to a large federal program to try and deal with those drought conditions. So it was, in essence, a climate change initiated project that required a regional approach. The approach the government took was through the U.S. Forest Service, where they did this feasibility analysis called Possibilities of Shelter Belt Planting in the Plains Region. What they came up with is what they called the Shelter Belt Zone, that red polygon, where they targeted tree windbreak planting in the Great Plains to alleviate the drought conditions. The program itself was called the Prairie States Forestry Project. It ran from 1935 to 1942. They planted over 200 million trees in over 18,000 miles of windbreaks. Not all of it inside the polygon, as you can see. They cheated east to try and improve the chances of tree survival where there was more rainfall. The trees were planted in six different states. So what's happened in the last 80 years is some of those windbreaks, in fact I've been in some of them, still exist, but many don't. The trees were planted, species were planted that didn't survive. There were cultural reasons to remove them. But on the other hand, others were planted. The practice worked. Farmers, many of them liked it. So they planted more of their own in the subsequent years. But we are in a situation now where renovation is on a lot of people's minds. What to do with these old windbreaks? They want to keep them. What should they do? The trees have died out. Different species have moved in. So there's a lot of interest in renovation, and this project was funded by the Sustainable Ag Research and Education Program, North Central Region, to look at some possibilities. It's a social economic project, so we had social science, economics, spatial analysis, tree biomass, and my little part there in red, the soil organic carbon. So it's part of the sustainability analysis of can we couple this standard established practice with in a new way in terms of carbon sequestration, ecosystem services, and maybe even bioenergy by removing the wood that's there now, replacing them with other trees, maybe fast-growing trees, with a potential market for bioenergy. So our strategy was we took the existing maps of the original shelter belt zone, and those shaded areas are where the trees were actually planted, the concentrated areas. And so we chose four states and two sites in each state to try and sample representative areas that would give us a regional assessment of what kind of properties are out there, what kind of tree growth, what kind of changes in soil organic carbon. We decided to go deep, so we dug soil pits at each site to 1.5 meters inside the trees and outside in adjacent cropland. And to try and improve our spatial sampling, we also took auger holes adjacent to these soil pits. We sampled at those depths, collected those samples, and have done a lot of analyses, but today I'm focusing on the soil organic carbon. We also took bulk density samples at those depths so that we could take our concentrations and calculate the stocks at each site. So here are our eight sites. We had one soil, McLeod, North Dakota, that has fine sand. The rest are medium to heavy textured soils. Of the eight sites, we had seven different tree species. The one pine species, the rest are broadleaf, or the two are and one red cedar site. Six of the sites are in some sort of forage, either for hay, native grassland, or pasture, and two are in row crop. However, the McLeod, Corsica East, and Marquette sites were all cropped until the trees were planted. So at the time the trees were planted, they were converted to non-cropping systems. So we have a range of tree age here also, quite a large range from 15 to over 90 years. This captures quite a variation in climate as well, range in mean annual temperature of 12 degrees Fahrenheit and over 10 inches in mean annual precipitation. So I guess I'm trying to convince you we had a pretty good regional sampling of these four states of the Great Plains. I'm going to focus on the next couple of slides on one site, and it's I'll use it as a typical data set, not a typical site. How's that? So on the upper left, we have the soil organic carbon concentration with depth. The green is the tree. The blue is the crop. And you can see largely what you expect. The concentration is high at the surface and decreases with depth. There's some difference. And this was a site where, both the tree and the a prairie restoration were accomplished 29 years before our sampling. On the right, you see the effect of the density changes. And so we have increased soil organic carbon at the 30 to 50 centimeter depth in the trees and some depletion at a deeper depth at the tree site. So part of the luxury of having the soil descriptions and being able to look at the soils and collect samples inside soil pits is that it gives you opportunities to interpret this kind of data, what actually is going on. So, for instance, we see differences in texture. The tree site has significantly more sand at the deeper depths. Now, these sites are only about 20 meters apart, so actually quite a lot of variation. And I was going to mention the fact that you can sample shallow at a lot of sites, deep at a few, generally, based on your resources. And this is when you wonder about the strategy of sampling only a few sites when you see this kind of variation over such a small distance. Bulk density was very high, so one of the interpretations we have is maybe those tree roots in particular cannot penetrate that high density layer. Bulk density approaching 1.8 is known to be limiting to root penetration. And then there are some differences in pH. And we know that this may have something to do with the hydrology, the growth habit of the crop, the grass versus the tree in this case, having to do when the water is used and also movement of carbonates in the profile as a result. So again, you know, some good news from some of those profile descriptions gives us interpretive value. And then some other things, not so much, like the depth of the A horizon doesn't really correlate so well with the changes that we see in soil organic carbon, which I'll show you in the next slide. But, you know, that's sort of a descriptive pedological approach, and we're looking at a purely chemical approach. So there are times when those two don't always complement each other. Depth to carbonates is another. We do measure soil inorganic carbon, but it's nice to see the pedological description of when they observe carbonates and what kind of carbonates they observe in the profile. And then you get to see fun things like big crotobinas with large animals burrowing in your pasture, and these bimodal soils in that were had an A horizon buried by sand dunes in the Red River Valley. So finally, the big finish here. Six of the eight sites, the trees had more soil organic carbon, down to 1.25 meters. These are the stalks. So the numbers in green are the increases compared to the crop site, as we call it, the crop site, although most of those sites are actually in forage. The blue sites were those sites that had previously been cropped before they were converted to forage when the trees were planted. So the Marquette site was basically a wash. You wouldn't really expect too much different. You planted native prairie side by side with trees. Neither were fertilized or managed. It was essentially a hunting property. And so they have relatively the same amounts of soil organic carbon. Then the Corsica site, same thing. It was converted to cropland, Corsica East, the same time the trees were planted. There's more variation, but there's no statistical difference. And then we have one site at Mead, which is the site that I've worked at before, which gave us anomalous results. And the soil pits indicate that we probably were in actually two different soils, again, about 20 meters apart. So bad choice of place to point the flag and dig the hole at that site. And again, that's one of the consequences of using an approach like this. Okay, on average, the SOC stocks in the first 1.25 meters were 2.9 kilograms per square meter greater than the adjacent fields. Now, we're covering a broad range of tree age, soil type, texture, lots of different properties here, but that's the average. The range, however, is plus 10.5 to minus 5. So there's a great deal of variation there. And if you're a company investing in carbon sequestration, that's the number that probably would be more concerning than the average. And we know, you know, the site characteristics are making a difference. It's the trees, their species, their age, the climate. And the climate is changing. It's obvious at some of these sites, actually, the climate's changing. And of course, when you're faced with disentangling things, you want to model, right? So we have an active collaboration with the Comet Farm team. And so hopefully the model will help smooth out some of the bumps in the road as we try to make some sort of regional assessment, regional analysis of what the potential carbon sequestration is for these practices. There's some data that still might be very useful, and that's the DEL-13C data, the stable carbon isotope data, which we have yet to analyze, which may be very insightful for interpreting not just the amount of carbon there, but the quality of it in terms of the dynamics and residence time. And lastly, we need to identify where these practices exist now. There's no database to tell us how many miles of windbreaks are out there, what their characteristics are. That'd be really, really valuable information in terms of the impact of this kind of data. And lastly, this is continuing on into some work where we're now looking at greenhouse gas fluxes and the effects of microclimate adaptation or effects due to the tree windbreaks. So with that, I'm finished. Thank you. Yes, the question is how much effect do we think the tree windbreaks have in terms of trapping windblown sediment? That's a very good question, and it very much depends on the site. We had a sandy site in Nebraska in a different study where there was a dune of soil inside the windbreak. And of course, you know, that's an artifact. It sequestered a lot of carbon, technically. On the one hand, unfortunately, it was an artifact of likely just one event. The isotope data and some other analysis have helped us try to sort that out. But we know, in fact, what happens is the isotope data shows contamination. And so that's when we know that there have been erosion impacts. So even though we can't use it for, you know, the dynamics of the carbon, it essentially tells us the site's been contaminated by deposition from the crop. The question is, do we look at upwind versus downwind side of the windbreaks? And again, not in this study, but we have in other studies where we did transects across the windbreak. And oddly enough, at the Mead site, the very first site we did this analysis, there was a difference in texture across the windbreak. Small, but very consistent.
I was just going to ask you about the number of samples you collected on the
In this study, There's one soil pit. We sampled three sides of the soil pit in two auger holes, so essentially five. But we composited the three inside the soil pit.
I'm just a little bit surprised about your site at Mead, Nebraska, where there was no effect.
Bad leadership, planting the flag in the wrong place. You know, you're looking for sites that don't have evidence of erosion, that the topography is smooth, or that you know, it's not in a loss or a deposition type location. And of course, the other problem that you have with any tree planting is there has been disturbance during establishment. And we have some sites where there's a obvious crown of when they cultivated, probably for weed control. And I'm open to suggestions about how to remove those artifacts. Some sites it's very small, other sites it seems obvious.
Why would that be higher inorganic carbon in the tree compared to cropland?
Well, that was depth to carbonates. So, yeah. So cropland tends to have the higher
carbon. Does it have something to do with the tree root distribution?
It has to do with when the water is used and from where it's extracted. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Our next.